Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, December 30th, 2004. Today's session is entitled Empowered for Peace, Becoming Overcomers of Evil. Session 2 of The Peace is the Way Retreat, subtitled Falling from Superiority to Solidarity, Isaiah's and Our Fall and Call, led by Bob Ekblad. Session number EKB 2004-02. Let's listen in.
This morning, our session is entitled Falling from Superiority to Solidarity, Isaiah and Our Fall and Call. So what I want to do is take us through the beginning part of Isaiah 1 to 6, focusing on chapter 6, which is the call of Isaiah, and looking at how that call, what that call might look like for us today. I'm going to begin with a prayer. Would someone like to say a prayer for us to begin? Is there a volunteer? Yeah?
Okay. Lord, in your mercy, you bring us together as a people concerned about the world and what's happening in it. As a people struggling to find peace in our own lives, to bring peace to others. Thank you for bringing us together here today and in the next days as we dialogue about how to be peace in the world. I'm going to ask this in your name. Amen.
Amen. Thank you. When we look at the prophet Isaiah, in any of the prophetic material, or any of the prophetic writings, one thing that is important to remember is that the prophets, it began before Israel had any kings, okay? And prophets were actually the ones who anointed the kings and sort of held them in check. And so one of their major roles was to be the voice of God, or to hear the voice of God, and to communicate that voice, the will of God to the powers that be during whatever king was in power. And so they had a very difficult role because the Messiah, or the anointed one, the king, would often sort of want to do his own thing. And so in Israel's history, you just have example after example of kings choosing the way of power and oppressing the weak. And they needed to be held in check by the prophets. Okay? And in the prophetic literature, you have two different kinds of prophets. You have the false prophets, who were the people that would stand with the kings and pat them on the back and say, "Yeah, it's great. Bomb the hell out of them. It's the will of God." You have the false prophets, and then you have the true prophets who would give a word that was not a popular word, that often got them into deep trouble, like Jeremiah, who got thrown in pits. And to carry on the role of the prophet before the powers was not an easy vocation. Okay? And I believe that the church is called to be a prophetic community, where we are hearing the word of God and we're not afraid to speak truth to power, and with all the risks and all that implied in that. Okay. But what I want to do is help us look at how, what is the place from which we can speak a prophetic word? What is the spiritual, social location out of which we can speak a prophetic word? We look at the book of Isaiah. Actually, I'm going to situate this in terms of one of my jail Bible studies. I think the people that I work with, most of the inmates in our prison system, jail system, and especially people from other countries, and I'm most familiar with Latino and Mexican people, they assume that anything bad that happens to them is God's will. Okay, so they're in jail, and it's God has finally caught up with them and busted them, and now they're going to be punished. by God. And so they get religious as sort of a desperate measure to try to suck up to the deity, you know, and to get God to back off and lighten up. And so I have Bible studies full of people that are their first maybe inclination to come to the Bible study is penance. Okay, it's to sort of do what they think God would approve of, so that they can maybe get a lesser sentence. Okay, and so my objective then is to subvert that theology, that dominant theology that associates the status quo with God's will, through helping them see in the stories of the scriptures that the status quo is not God's will at all. And in fact, God often has the prophetic literature helps, is very easy to work with in the jail, because it really exposes the dominant culture and you know, kind of highlights the abuses and the injustices, and shows that God's will is very far from the status quo. Okay, so some examples. And when we look at this material, people are shocked, you know, that the inmates, they just can't believe that there'd be words against the status quo. Like, if we look at Isaiah, if you all have Bibles, I'm going to be looking at a number of different scriptures in the beginning part of Isaiah. If we look at Isaiah 1, 12 to 13, can someone read that?
When you come to appear before me, who asked this from your hand? Trample my courts no more. Bringing offerings is futile. Incense is an abomination to me. New moon and Sabbath and calling of convocation. I cannot endure solemn assemblies with hate, iniquity.
Okay, and verse 16 and 17?
What's it, chapter 1?
Chapter 1, Isaiah 1.
Wash yourself, make yourself clean. Remove the evil of your doings from before my eyes. Cease to do evil, learn to do good. Seek justice, rescue the oppressed, defend the orphan, plead for the widow.
So in these two scriptures, God's exposure of the crimes of the governing authorities, you know, like injustice in the courts, surprised people who assumed the state is always sanctioned by God. And, you know, Romans 13 has been underlined in boldface and used as, I think, in a really abusive way. And understood it in an abusive way. It's just the sanctioning of whatever happens, whatever the state does. Right? You know, one little text that sort of gives the state such a strong legitimation has really been used as a refuge for a lot of Christians to hide from their prophetic role of, you know, being resistors. And when people see that the state is actually being so harshly critiqued in these scriptures, it's very powerful. It's like, what? You know, God is not on the side of the powers? There's just an automatic assumption that God is on the side of the one that has the power. Okay? Because God is all-powerful. And so if God is all-powerful and God is sovereign, then everything that is happening must be God's will. Because why would God, an all-powerful sovereign, let governments do what they do unless it was God's will? And there's sort of an assumption that, okay, if God is allowing the powers to do what they want, you know, the Department of Homeland Security to make massive arrests along the border, or to deport people who've been here 25 years and, you know, for some crime, and separate them from their families. And there's just an assumption that must be God's will. And so if it's critiqued in the Bible itself, the similar sort of contemporary actions, I guess, people find it, it just provides this space for being able to help people see things freshly. Well, let's look at verse 20.
I think when good Christian folks read these verses, we tend to sort of privatize, you know, have a very narrow focus. It's just talking to this individual and that individual and that individual about their peculiar sins and failings. And I think part of it's just bad Bible study, that to not see the whole context, that all of Zion and the people, everybody's being, addressed here. But I think our culture and everything, in the religious culture, just tends to personalize and privatize it, and then so that's another reason we don't hear the address to a people or to ways of a nation, to governments. And
yeah, I think you're right. The individualism keeps us from hearing these words collectively. How about verse 22 and 23, chapter 1? Let's read that.
Your silver has become dross. Your choice wine is diluted with water. Your rulers are rebels, companions of thieves. They all love bribes and chase after gifts. They do not defend the cause of the fatherless. The widow's case does not come before them.
Okay. There's another text that I don't have the citation for, but it, maybe it's the next verse. It says, the Lord entered into judgment with the elders and the princes of his people. It is you who have devoured the vineyard, the spoil of the poor is in your houses. What do you mean by crushing my people, by turning the face of the poor, says the Lord God of hosts. One of the strongest kind of denunciations of, you know, of the opulence, I guess, of consumerism of the time of Isaiah, which is Isaiah 3, 16 and following. Could someone read that for us?
The Lord said, because the daughters of Zion are haughty and walk with outstretched necks, glancing wantonly with their eyes, mincing along as they go, tinkling with their feet, the Lord will afflict with scabs the heads of the daughters of Zion, and the Lord will lay bare their secret hearts. Sorry, how far did you
go? Oh, yeah, keep going right to the end.
In that day, the Lord will take away the finery of the anklets, the headbands and the crescents, the pendants, the bracelets and the scarves, the headdresses, the armlets, the sashes, the perfume boxes and the amulets, the signet rings and nose rings, the festal robes, the mantles, the cloaks and the handbags, the garments of gauze, the linen garments, the turbans and the veils. Instead of perfume, there will be a stench, and instead of a sash, a rope, and instead of well-set hair, baldness, and instead of a rich robe, a binding of sackcloth. Instead of beauty, shame. Your men shall fall by the sword, and your warriors in battle. And her gates shall lament and mourn, ravaged. She shall sit upon the ground.
Okay. So once again, a critique of the powers and of the people who are beneficiaries of power subverts the dominant theology of retribution, okay, which says that whatever is happening is God's will. And that theology of retribution, I think many of us have grown up with it. I grew up on Mercer Island, which is a wealthy suburb of Seattle, and grew up with all kinds of benefits, you know, water skiing on the lake every day during the summer, and skiing every weekend up in the Cascades, and fancy vacations going to Hawaii. And I used to remember, you know, praying, oh Lord, thank you for just blessing our family. Just thank you for the incredible blessing. I mean, I believe we need to be thankful for all things, okay, but to assume that the wealth of our family was God's blessing is the other side of the theology of retribution. Mm-hmm. Which assumes that curses or bad things must be God's will too, then, right? So, you know, we have we need to recognize that this theology of retribution goes deep, and it really reflects the dominant theology that probably all of us have grown up with. The assumption that when bad things happen, there must be some kind of a just reason for it. But like when my parents lost their home, at my dad's 65th birthday, he had to leave our home because it was repossessed by the banks because he went through Chapter 7 bankruptcy. My parents automatically assumed that it was a punishment because they hadn't tithed enough. Okay, I mean, that was a struggle that my parents are still, and I feel free to share this because I know they wouldn't mind me sharing it. I've asked their permission, but that's a very common, deep. This theology is deep and it's far-reaching, and it really affects the masses out there. Okay. So in my jail Bible study, most of the Mexicans would be undocumented, and then there's a lot of white guys too who are there. And the Mexicans would all assume that, I mean, they're walking around, creeping around, I mean, they feel like they're happy. Like they're creeping around like cockroaches. Some of them describe themselves that way. We're like little cockroaches, and when the light shines, we have to scurry into the cracks. You know, and there's an assumption that when they finally do get busted, that okay, well, God has finally caught them. Okay, and I'll say, well, who arrested you? And I'll say, well, the Mount Vernon Police Department. And I'll, you know, and I try to make a differentiation, but they don't. They just assume that powers that be are God. And So anyway, in this text from Isaiah, what we have is I want us to look at Isaiah chapter 6 now.
Just before going on with this great chapter, I think, but regarding that retribution, I mean, this kind of language we just read could easily lead to that understanding, you know, because it sounds like God's behind it all, so that when Assyria or whatever comes, that it's part of God's plan to get back at them for being, you know, unjust people.
Yeah, I mean, and there's two ways of looking at that. One, we could see this as natural consequences too,
right? Okay?
That if you are going to pursue your own wealth at the expense of the poor, you know, that eventually things are going to, there's going to be a reversal, okay? Because this, and God is on the side of the oppressed, okay? And so watch out. Don't assume that because things are going well that that's a sign of God's favor.
But part of, yeah, I know. I think it's a very difficult question because the writers of the Bible, the prophets, everybody, see God intimately involved in the events of history and so forth. So it's very difficult to see all of that and not somehow have a way of distinguishing. Well, it's not like God's just totally pulling the strings and everything has happened.
Yeah, and part of the role of the prophetic community is to identify what is God actually about? What is God doing in history right now? You know, is it what the dominant, you know, what the princes and, you know, the rulers are saying? Is that what God is really about? Is God sanctioning their campaigns, their military campaigns, or their economic system? You know, or is God about something else?
Right.
And so great discernment is necessary. There's no way to, I guess, to turn it into, you know, one of the tendencies of the left, the Christian left, is to just replace spiritual discernment of God's movement in history with a moralistic system.
Right.
Okay, well, that's the danger of the right or the left, for that matter.
Right.
That's just a human tendency, is to want to replace a code of ethics or you know, or a, yeah, an ethical system for, you know, for the voice of God. Okay, so
one of the most poignant times in terms of this issue of seeing, of giving thanks to God for salvation or something, and then, as you said, the flip side of giving thanks to God for having blessed your family and you have all these benefits, was our pediatrician we had years ago, who was a survivor of Auschwitz. And the very first time he ever told his story was at this gathering held in our parish. And a woman asked this kind of leading question, you know, to get him to give thanks to God for that he made it through, you know, that he was saved. And he caught on and he said, well, I have trouble doing it like that because does that imply that God intended for my sister and my mother and my father and everybody else to die? You know, it's really tricky.
Definitely. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so, I got something to say about that. I've read quite a few materials from survivors of concentration camps, and many of them deny God, basically, after that, after the experience. And they find it very difficult to relate to God. You know, why was this done to me randomly? And sort of like the prison thing, you know, but they have a very difficult time.
Oh, yeah. So. Yeah, my whole initiation into reading the Bible with people began in Israel when I was 20 years old. And I got in the kibbutz just to learn Hebrew half day, work half day. And you had to be an immigrant to be on this type of kibbutz, so called an ulpan. We stayed in Hebrew half day, and so I mean, you had to be Jewish, so I told them I was Jewish, based on Galatians, you know, where through faith in Christ we're all children. And I was reading the Bible one day, just on my own, and I was pretty much kind of outside the church and had left the church when I was younger, but still had my own faith and was kind of struggling, and had gone to Europe because of the Holocaust, my studies in history, I read a lot of material, a lot of stuff about the Holocaust, and spent time in some of the concentration camps. And I had a contact, my main contact in Israel was a Holocaust survivor who'd been in Auschwitz, and I was with their family, and then went on this kibbutz. So I was struggling with these sorts of questions, and my Cuban roommate, I had a Cuban guy who lived right next door, and he saw me reading the Bible one day, and he just says, how can you, I've lost all respect for you. You know, how can you, a Jewish brother, waste your time with this bullshit, you know, this, I mean, what are you doing, you know, reading the Bible? You know, I have no respect, you know, you're an imbecile. And he really was hard on me, you know, and I said, well, you know, behind me, why, you know? He says, well, you know, what did God do to defend our people from the Holocaust? You know, how could there be a God? And if there is a God, this is just an evil God. And so anyway, I just said, well, have you read the Torah? And he goes, no, I never have and I never will. And I said, I have a hard time respecting your critique of me if you haven't even read the Torah. But why don't we read the Torah together? And if it's all bullshit, I'll throw it out too. I mean, I'm searching myself, and let's read it together and discuss together. And I don't know, I mean, I don't know that much, but maybe together we can learn something. And so he said, okay, I'll go for that. So we began reading every day in the orange groves after work, and we just had an amazing experience of discovering through the stories of, well, especially Genesis and Exodus, you know, that it's kind of hard to get a whole lot out of Leviticus. But it was a powerful experience of just kind of grappling with these questions. And not that all those questions were answered, but I believe that that the scriptures offer us far deeper, more complex answers to some of these questions, and often don't even answer, offer us answers. I mean, they often just leave us with questions. Well, if we look at, just briefly, if we throw out like Isaiah's times, you had some of the main sins that are depicted by the prophet Isaiah are the trampling of the courts, injustice in the courts, bribes, people of privilege getting special benefits over the marginalized. You have social class divisions that were pretty extreme in Judah before the exile, you know, where you had a minority of wealthy group of people increasing their wealth at the expense of a majority of poor people. You had, you know, princes and leaders who were using religion to sanction their own enrichment. What are some of the contemporary examples that you would see? If we just for 2 or 3 minutes, let's just throw out some injustices that you yourself see that strike you as evident.
Uh-huh. Well, statistically, since the Reagan era, the wealth has become extremely concentrated in this area. A country where it used to be maybe 20% were controlled the wealth, and the other, I mean, now it's up in about 2% control. Well, I don't know what the new 70-80% of the money in the United States.
Yeah. Okay. So just the division between the wealthy and the poor,
sort of the running of things by folks like Walmart, that pushing so that it, you know, so we're not going to have health benefits and just pay and so forth, and then that somehow puts pressure on your other companies to be able to compete like that.
Okay, so the big, huge, mega kind of stores coming into communities and wiping out their competition here.
Yeah. I don't know. What I see is increasing greed of large corporations. So it's not enough to make a profit. You have to make an increasing profit each year. And so then you have to turn the screws down more on the workers because, of course, you deserve what you've earned, and you know, on the top, and so it's not, profit isn't enough. It has to be increasing profit, and you're not successful if you're not, you know, you're not a, if it isn't increasing, and that's just plain green.
Yeah. And then the producers of goods too, buying at lower prices, yeah, which is what Walmart.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
So
exactly.
Proud of,
so
you know,
yeah,
always sell for less.
So you decrease. everything for everyone else. Yeah.
Anybody else have anything to throw out?
Uh-huh. I think one of the hugest things for me is the change globally of food from being nourishment and a basic human right into being a commodity. And that changes our environmental systems, our marketing, and it's everything. It's not all the corporations, it's the individual family and person in the way we purchase and what we want and what we want now.
And cheap.
That has totally changed how we use the earth to feed.
And then also just the way food is now used as a negotiation tool countries in terms of sanctions and even in this state I was thinking that it's a real injustice how we treat the poorest of the poor. I have a friend who's on welfare with a small child and is living off of $400 a month. And she has to fight for every single piece of assistance she might need. She has to fight. And
I think the use of time is another one. It's you know, that meals are tied into having two wage earners, and the mom doesn't have time to really prepare big meals, and there isn't a whole lot of time to eat them, and there isn't, you know, I could go on, but there's a lot of obsession about time and not having enough, or, you know, whatever.
Definitely. Any other thing that we want to throw out there?
The whole unsustainability of the way in which we live our lives and the world is going, such that global warming is part of the picture, but quality of life which respects the planet and its limits is something that seems to have gotten thrown out of everybody's consciousness. Yeah. And what we will leave to our children and grandchildren, is the future of the planet and its quality of life for all of us.
All the forms of discrimination against peoples, whether it's economic or racial or gender or sexual orientation and so forth.
Age-related.
Age, okay, you know, it comes to all the time you see signs of that.
There's something really troubling about this country in particular, that for people to make their decisions, they have to have some broad understanding of the world, and that the way we're given information or educated or all those things leads us to a totally false picture of reality and a totally false understanding of good behavior, of good goals.
When I ask the inmates where they see oppression, where they see injustice, first things they mentioned are underpaid, you know, being underpaid as immigrant workers, you know, being taken advantage of by often desperate farmers who are desperate because of globalist forces that are beyond their control, but who still exploit the workers. Rich landowners exploiting peasants in Mexico and Central America to the point where they can't survive and they have to migrate. Drug dealers taking advantage of desperate addicts. That's a really common one. America bombing Afghanistan and Iraq, as mentioned. Discrimination. Racial profiling by local law enforcement. Unreasonably harsh sentences and fines by the courts. Having licenses suspended for almost any offense you could imagine, so people get out of jail and they can't go to work without breaking the law. And the sanctions are heavy if you are busted for driving with a suspended license. You get up to a year in jail in our county. Many people spend that kind of time if they have like a fourth or fifth of the time that they're arrested driving with a suspended license. But how are people supposed to work if there's not a public transportation system that can get them out to the fields or to the factories, places where they haven't, you know, to find work? So I mean, people are overwhelmed by the injustices. Mm-hmm. And okay, what I'd like to do, just thinking about our contemporary context now, I'd like to, us to read the call of Isaiah. The call of Isaiah is really an exemplary call of a religious insider, okay, which compared to the people that I normally read the Bible with, we're religious insiders, okay? I know many of you have your own stories and you might find yourself outsiders and feel like outsiders in your faith communities, or maybe you're not part of faith community, so I don't want to just give a blanket generalization that we're all religious insiders, but compared to the folks who are felons and the you know, undocumented kind of folks on the margins of in my jail, you know, we're religious. We're insiders, and you know, it's interesting. I grew up with several stories of conversion being sort of lifted up as the model conversion stories, and one was the story of Nicodemus. Mm-hmm. Okay, and the other was the story of the Apostle Paul. And how many of you who grew up in the church heard those stories as sort of model stories of conversion? Okay. It's interesting, both of them are conversion stories of religious insiders,
right?
Mm-hmm. Not of notorious sinners. Okay, both are conversion stories of Pharisees. Okay. And it's so tragic that we've used those stories as sort of models for conversion among outsiders and people on the margins of society, without really recognizing that there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of encounters that are mentioned in the Gospels between Jesus and people who were the marginalized at his time. You know, the Samaritan woman, lepers and lame and blind, and you know, so many tax collectors, and there were so many different models for how encounters between God and humans take place, that it would be so much more fruitful, you know, for the masses or whatever, for folks out there on the margins. But we've elevated two conversion stories that are both conversions of those that already thought that they were converted, right? Those that were already convinced that, you know, that they knew God face to face, okay? But I really believe that these two stories have a lot to say to us, much like the conversion of Isaiah has a lot to say to us. The conversion of Isaiah is one of the earlier stories of a conversion of a religious insider. In this story, you have Isaiah. He is he's going to church. Basically, he's many people considered him to be a priest, and he was in the temple at the time of his conversion, of his encounter. And in order to be able to even go into the temple, you had to be qualified. I mean, you had to be ceremonially clean. And in order to be clean, you had to be in compliance with the Torah. Okay, so to even enter into this holy place, one assumed, I mean, you had to have made yourself, you know, sort of righteous and worthy in a sense through purification rites. Okay, so check this out. Could someone read for us Isaiah 6? Verses 1, let's see, we're going to read just 1 through 5.
In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne high, lofty, and the hem of his robe filled the temple. Seraphs were in attendance above him. Each had 6 wings. With 2 they covered their faces. With 2 they covered their feet, we'll call it, and with 2 they flew. And one called to another and said, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. The pivots on the threshold shook at the voices of those who called, and the house filled with smoke. And I said, Woe is me, I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips. Yet my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts.
Okay, so here's Isaiah. He goes to church. He goes to the temple. I don't know if it was on the Sabbath or what day it was, but suddenly God, you know, actually shows up. okay, when Isaiah is in the temple. And Isaiah has an encounter with God that shatters his religious system. There's all these seraphs and, you know, these angelic sort of creatures that are part of the vision. I mean, I assume that this is a vision that was fairly subjective vision that not everyone who was in the temple at that moment saw, but this was maybe an individual experience that Isaiah is bringing us into, you know, where suddenly God is viewed as holy, 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 okay? Now, the word holy has just lost almost all meaning, I think, for most of us, at least. You know, for me to recognize that the word, the word actually means, it comes from kadosh, kadash, which is to be separate or other. And it could be translated as even strange. Okay, so strange, strange, strange is the Lord Almighty would be, a much more accurate translation, or foreign, or other, or different, whoa, you are different. You are just not what I thought you were, God. You know, Isaiah meets God, and his whole theology is just wiped out. Okay, it just crashes and crumbles to the ground because Isaiah meets the living God, and that God is not who Isaiah had prepared himself to encounter. Okay, this is what the Lacanian psychotherapists call a choc du réel, a reality shock. Okay, where there's the real of God's presence is suddenly encountered, and so Isaiah goes from seeing himself as sort of Isaiah plus God sort of this fused unity of religious comfort. To suddenly God, there's this gap, there's a division, that takes place, and God is seen as much further away, and Isaiah is seen as much lower, okay? So, and this sort of distance between God and between the religious insider and God is kind of a necessary stage in history in a real conversion process. This is exactly what happens with Paul, or something similar happens with the Apostle Paul when he meets God and he's on his way to thinking that he's doing God's sort of will, right, to wipe out the Christian sect, and then God meets him, Jesus meets him and says, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? And it's like a complete upset of his theological assumptions. Okay, so anyway, God, with conversions of religious insiders almost always create distance between religious insiders and God, whereas conversions of outsiders do the opposite. Okay, most people in the jail system and prison system, people on the margins, and of any culture would normally see themselves down here. Okay. They would see, the drug users, homeless, name some categories. Alcoholics.
Undocumented.
I mean, who are the unclean of our day?
Prostitutes.
HIV guys.
Prostitutes, HIV. Okay. These folks already feel this distance, okay? So when Jesus shows up and touches lepers and eats with sinners and does all that Jesus does, you have God coming close, God coming present. Whereas the conversion, and that's how conversion happens, is when people who already feel the distance are are experience the embrace. Okay, but religious insiders need the opposite movement in order for them to, you know, to kind of get a true perspective of their condition. Okay, in order for true solidarity to happen. So what happens is God is viewed here as clean, holy. And Isaiah suddenly sees himself. How does he describe himself in verse 5?
Unclean.
Verse
5?
Unclean.
Unclean.
Okay. What's the first thing that he says?
Lost. I am lost.
I am lost, you know, or woe is me. It's like, I'm damned. You know, I'm damned. Okay. It's like, woe is me. It's like, you know, I am... there's a lot of terms we could use here. But anyway, suddenly Isaiah sees himself as, you know, as damned, as unclean. Okay.
Just the experience itself seems kind of frightening. These seraphs are really strange, you know. So I think besides that sense of uncleanness, it must have just been
terror.
Yeah.
Dawn hangs out with weird company.
Yeah, yeah, probably all these seraphs with these wings. You know, kind of weird. So anyway, foreign. Let's get these words out here. Different. Strange. Okay. So Isaiah's little comfortable religion is forever destroyed. Okay, and Isaiah finds himself he says, I am a man of unclean lips, among a people of unclean lips. Okay, so suddenly there's solidarity, there's true solidarity that is happening. The encounter with God thrusts Isaiah into the masses of people that he has differentiated himself from, that he's considered himself superior to, right? The us-them distinctions that allow a religious insider to feel, okay, well, I'm a righteous one, have been wiped out, and Isaiah sees himself as just one of the masses. Okay, I'm a man of unclean lips, among a people of unclean lips, for my eyes have seen the Lord of hosts, okay?
Which itself is frightening, because the assumption might be that only happens when you die. I mean, you know, to do that is I no longer have life on this earth anymore.
Right. Yeah.
So how would a drug user in jail, the conversion experience, how would that be different? I didn't quite catch.
Well, the conversion experience in the jail, but what people need to hear isn't the distance between themselves and God, and that God is other and strange and foreign, okay? Because they already feel that, big time. Mm-hmm. Okay, they don't need judgment, in other words. They don't need... what's happening here is this is the function of judgment. The whole role of judgment is a positive. I used to see judgment as such a negative thing. Even the word, I just wanted to delete it from anywhere, anything.
So it's more like amazing grace.
But judgment is actually something that exposes the truth of the situation, right? And it is a tremendous grace when it occurs. But you know, but judgment, if things are just left there, exposed, if our brokenness and our uncleanness or whatever are exposed and we're not and we're left there, then that's a state of, that leads to shame and hiding, you know, and it's not redemptive, right? So most of the inmates and folks on the margins of our society, they feel that they're damned and unclean, and in order for that view of themselves to change, they need to experience God as coming close and as embracing them and accepting them in their brokenness. Okay.
Well, then also, if I, the religious insider, can have the awareness like Isaiah does that I'm in the midst of a people of unclean lips, that I'm not any great exemplar of holiness, then I can be better at welcoming all these other people of unclean lips, you know, to hear this of the God who is actually gracious.
Yeah, yeah.
But if I feel like, well, I've already excelled in religiosity, and it's only you who are failing, and you know, well, what kind of good news is that going to be?
Right, right.
So, yeah, so anyway, the message of the gospel to the outsiders is a God who comes close, okay? A God who, you know, a light shines in the darkness. And, you know, the whole message of Jesus' whole ministry in Galilee is a ministry away from the center to the periphery and, you know, and away from sort of the religious insiders towards the outsiders and the rejected, okay? And encountering, there's just beautiful, beautiful. And we have what I do in the jail basically is just take people through story after story after story after story in the Gospels, and that's where I focus probably most of my attention. I do a lot of Old Testament work as well, but because it's there too, you know, there's just story after story in the Torah, you know, that shows the same teachings, right, about God coming close to the marginalized and or to people that already feel the distance, but in order for so anyway, what happens in this story is a religious, you know, someone who considers themselves superior and identifies themselves over and against the broken and the lost and the damned, and feels like they're on the right side, you know, the right side of God, suddenly meets God and finds out that they're one of the many. Okay, what are some of the us them distinctions that we experience? Where we find ourselves, I mean, maybe either the them or the us, on one side of that story, on one side of that divide in our culture.
Inside or outside of the church?
I guess I'm just talking about all of us in this room right here, wherever we find ourselves. Where do we experience being on one side or another of the of and us, them sort of divide?
With money.
Okay.
Feeling like there are people that are a lot more well-off.
Like aging.
Aging,
yeah. Sometimes with family.
With family?
We just have different perspectives.
Mm-hmm. I think the opposite of being in a place where you're really surrounded by poverty and fearing for whatever it is you happen to possess, you know, little whatever, large or small, you possess at that moment, fear of being robbed or attacked. I mean, I've had both experiences.
I felt us, them recently with the folks who also are Christian, yet their notion of Christian was to do things like support war in Iraq and Bush and everything, and I just felt so strange, separate.
Yeah, across the political divide, those who both voted for Bush and those who didn't.
Right. So if we looked at clean and unclean from our own perspective, or, you know, if we tried to move that into our own contemporary context, where is it that we would see ourselves as clean over and against the unclean?
Voting on the right side.
On the correct side.
Correct. On the correct. Yeah. I'm kind of thinking, you know, those people are on the wrong voting side and I'm on the right voting side.
Yeah.
Is it, most of us have documentation that allows us to legally be in this country.
Yeah.
Which makes us way on the inside.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about our neighbors, near people who know us, but we, it's awesome to try to talk about God to them. You know, I feel like, who am I to talk with them about God, you know, and what might they think? And it's still, I think, an awesome thing to represent and to speak for God, yeah, with neighbors.
You get
with
the language divide quite a bit.
The language divide.
Education.
I think cultural divisions too, you know, like just going into a quote-unquote redneck place and, you know, just seeing somebody and how they talk or how their politics is and just thinking, you're just kind of rolling your eyes type of thing. I mean, I think that's making a division and separation, actually.
I've experienced it with theology. I mean, in Central America, we had a lot of the Pentecostals and groups like that really came against us because we were preaching grace. And mm-hmm. And then we watched in the 80s when the whole church, you know, was so much of the conservative church was siding with what Reagan was doing. You know, of course, you see the same thing now where you have masses of Christian denominations that are churches,
you know, huge numbers of Christian people who feel like it's, you know, to vote for Bush is just, it's just a Christian thing to do. And if you're voting Democrat, then you're not even, how could you be a believer? I mean, you know. And so I find myself distancing myself. For years and years, I've distanced myself from this whole part of the body of Christ that I consider to be, you know, sort of off, captivated by ideology, by, you know, by Republican, you know, conservative, neoliberal, whatever ideology. Have any of you experienced a similar experience to Isaiah, where, you know, where you're, you had some sort of an encounter with God, or with some sort of an experience where there was a shock that shattered your view of yourself, and it sort of placed you among the masses, among the unclean, that you feel like sharing?
Just many, numerous times, but not any dramatic thing like I see. Just in Scandinavian modest ways.
When I was in Central America, I was telling you guys last night about my experience in Guatemala, and I grew up in a very Republican family where my parents were precinct chairpersons for a Republican Party in, you know, on Mercer Island. And it was like, I grew up just assuming that everything that we were a Christian nation, that we were founded on Christian principles, that we were, everything we were doing was just to save the world, and we were promoters of democracy and human rights everywhere. And, you know, and we needed a strong U.S. military in order to make sure that human rights just flourished everywhere around the world. And,
yeah, right.
And you know, when I went to Central America and found, and I began to learn about sort of the dark side of U.S. History in that region, you know, I definitely experienced a feeling of being a sort of an Isaiah-like conversion in a way. I mean, I was blasted out of my, of any sense of you know, of being part of a righteous nation, and felt myself to be, you know, really unclean, socially unclean. And in moving to Honduras, I think in the beginning our ministry was somewhat of a penance-like ministry, you know, where we were trying to wash ourselves clean of our white, you know, sort of privileged skin through serving the poor. Okay, and it was really out of that sort of place of just sort of groveling at the bottom that that we had another experience, which I think is a similar experience to what happens in this book of you know, in verse 6. Okay, I think one of the dangers of having some kind of an encounter that shows us to be unclean is that if we're working from a place of guilt and of I guess awareness of the weight of our own social, you know, responsibility, without sort of the next stage in Isaiah's conversion process, that, you know, that actually we can end up being part of another us-them sort of divide, you know, where we become the righteous warriors against injustice and against oppression, over and against, you know, sort of, you know, the scummy, you know, sort of status quo folks who are maintaining the system of oppression, right? So check this out, you guys, because someone read verse 6 and 7.
Then one of the seraphs flew to me, holding a live coal that had been taken from the altar with a pair of tongs. The seraph touched my mouth with it and said, "Now that this has touched your lips, your guilt has departed and your sin is blotted out." Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send, and who will go for us?" And I said, "Here am I, send me." And he said, "Go and say to this people..."
Actually, stop right there, that's good enough.
Okay.
Okay, so in this story you have, you know, from this place of total solidarity, where suddenly Isaiah sees himself as damned and unclean, the next step is that there's one of the divine, you know, one of the you know, one of God's entourage, the entourage of the different strange foreign one, you know, sort of comes with, you know, with this coal from the tongue, with tongues, the hot coal from the altar, and initiates a move of forgiveness, right? Of divine initiated forgiveness, okay? Where God, apart from any kind of religious posturing, to sort of suck up to, you know, to God in any way, through becoming clean, you know, through religious observances, the clean, you know, someone from the clean side, you know, sort of breaks the divide and shows up in the midst of Isaiah's, you know, sort of depraved condition, and offers him forgiveness. Okay, and it's that offering of forgiveness that frees Isaiah to his true prophetic task. Okay, so his prophetic task is out of place of total solidarity with the unclean, understood as the unclean, understood as including all the religious insiders, right, of his time. You know. So what's happening in this story is Isaiah. I mean, there's a complete reversal, right? Because Isaiah, as a member of the dominant class, you know, of the, you know, where the women with their outstretched necks, you know, and the tinkling, you know, all the splendor and the wealth and the princes with the trampling of the courts, all of that was seen as divinely sanctioned. You know, in Isaiah's encounter with God, all of that is reversed, okay? And everything that Isaiah understood to be associated with God here is down here, okay? And Isaiah himself is called out of that place, you know, of solidarity with anyone and everything unclean, to a ministry, a prophetic role, before the powers and principalities of his time. Okay, so if we think about it that way, look now at verse 8 again, and let's read 8 through 13.
Then I heard the Lord say, "Whom shall I send? Who will be our messenger?" I answered, "I will go, send me." So he told me to go and give the people this message. No matter how much you listen, you will not understand. No matter how much you look, you will not know what is happening. Then he said to me, "Make the minds of these people dull, their ears deaf, and their eyes blind, so that they cannot see or hear or understand. If they did, they might turn to me and be healed." I asked, "How long will it be like this, Lord?" He answered, "Until the cities are ruined and empty, until the houses are uninhabited, until the land itself is a desolate wasteland, I will send the people far away and make the whole land desolate. Even if one person out of 10 remains in the land, he too will be destroyed. He will be like the stump of an oak tree that has been cut down."
What? That was the end of verse 13?
Doesn't say the whole stump is a stump?
Oh, well, I've got the parentheses. The stump represents a new beginning for God's people.
Okay, okay, so this encounter that Isaiah has with this other strange, foreign, different God that suddenly causes him to fall from his perch of privilege and superiority. And into a place where he's just one of the many, you know, and a total brother with, you know, with all the outcasts, and including his own insider community that he now sees as, you know, as damned, right? It's out of a place of absolute solidarity where there's no us-them distinctions that Isaiah receives his call, or as his first receives his God's. God-initiated forgiveness, right? Where he's purified by, you know, by a divine movement, right, towards him. So he experiences really what, you know, what the marginalized of Jesus' time must have experienced when, you know, when Jesus came close and showed up in their village and touched and healed, right? Isaiah here is experiencing the gospel the way the marginalized would experience it, as a brother to the marginalized. Okay, but that frees him to a new prophetic role to the mainstream. Okay, because as a mainstream person who's had this encounter, now God is sending him where? Back to the mainstream. Okay, go and say to this people. Okay, hear, but don't perceive.
So it sounds like his mission is not to go and enlighten the people into God's ways, but that he is the actual method by which these people will not understand. He is sent to tell them to listen, but not to understand. What does that mean?
Well,
Christian failure.
Yeah, I think it means that the task of actually being a bearer of a prophetic word among insiders, you know, in a pre-exilic sort of place, is fraught with difficulty, because there's an assumption that the only way that people are going to really turn is, well, I think with Isaiah we can see that it can happen through a divine encounter, okay? But apart from a divine encounter, it's like, okay, how long, O Lord? How long will people not understand? Will they not hear? Will they not see? You know, well, until cities lie waste and are without inhabitant. Okay, and it's like exile, as seen as almost a necessary stage in order for, you know, for transformation to occur.
I don't really understand this whole part, because I feel like what God is saying is to make people's minds dull, make their eyes blind, make them not be able to hear. Because if they could hear and see and understand, they could be healed by me. But I don't want them to be healed. I want to exile them and destroy their land. And I don't understand.
I think
what's the point of that? Why not just heal them? If he can forgive Isaiah with a coal, why not just forgive everybody?
Yeah, and that's the question is, And that's what Isaiah has the opportunity, okay? And what we have in the next 33 chapters is just prophetic oracle after prophetic oracle, where the prophets are speaking words of God to the people, but the people aren't paying attention to it, okay? Because it's too difficult, okay? It's calling them to something that they're not willing to do.
But God is saying here that he doesn't, my sense is he doesn't want them to be healed. It says, you know, shut their eyes, stop their ears, so that they may not look with their eyes and listen with their ears and comprehend with their minds and turn and be healed.
But maybe
I don't want them to be healed.
Maybe it's our own eyes and our own hearts that aren't going to understand. And maybe we need God's eyes and God's heart, because it's our own. It's not seeing the stuff. And we have to realize that until we can realize that we need God's eyes and God's hearts to be peacemakers, you know. God has to make peace with us first so that we can make peace with the world. Until we can realize that, you know, we're gonna just live in desolation. Until we come to that bottoming out, you know, if I can use that term, I think that there needs to be a bottoming out, you know, before we can actually realize that we can't do it on our own. We can't be God's messengers. We can't be peacemakers. We can't do these things and our own power.
It's not going to happen through, you know, through human striving. Okay, I think is what I understand this message to be. You know, you're not going to become. You can't save yourself, you know, through getting it. You know, I mean, through human initiated, you know, kind of effort. Okay, the only way that. You know, what happened to Isaiah was, you know, was God showed up, okay, and perhaps Isaiah was open to it. I don't know, but I mean, yeah, it's ominous.
I think this is just one of those many places that where ends up there's an ambiguity or a tension between prescriptive and descriptive, and I think that's even you can tell me what you think about on this, but in Hebrew sometimes this happens where it's kind of part of the language that there's an ambiguity. If it's being descriptive or prescriptive? Is it saying, this is just the way it is, so I give you this job, and you're going to go tell people things, and they won't get it, they won't do it, they won't listen? Or is it, I'm giving you this job, and part of this job is a guarantee. I mean, it's like, I plan it from the start, you know, that they won't hear. Which one is it? Is it God making the people not hear, or is it just like, I'm telling you, they're not going to hear it. It's just the way it is.
Yeah. If you all went out from this week and told everybody, proclaimed just loud and clear, everyone, look, U.S. empire is doomed. It's on its way down. It's crashing. This whole American experiment has been an absolute failure. And you know, within 10 years, the USA will not exist anymore, right, as a nation. Okay. It's the fall of the USA is coming. How do you think people would respond to you?
Put you in the middle ward.
They won't pay much attention.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, I think this is what Isaiah is saying. Isaiah is saying, look, when you're dealing with religious insiders and you know who are beneficiaries of a whole economic and religious system, change does not happen through choice. Yeah, we don't make choice. We don't make the right choices. In this country, we have an ideology of choice. Okay, we're free choice. I mean, we have a cult of the human will. You know, where we elevate human decision and inform decision to the level of, I mean, of an idol. Okay, and we assume, and that's what the whole American experiment is about. It's based on the assumption that enlightened will, enlightened free choice will lead to the good and the right. Okay. What Isaiah is, I think, saying, I mean, what this text is saying is that's not the way salvation happens. Okay, it's not the way liberation happens. Liberation happens through an encounter with, you know, with God that might break through. It might break through the hardness. It did for Isaiah. Okay, so even the call of Isaiah gives us hope that it could happen for us and it could happen for our contemporaries. You know, we might see God as different, strange, other, and experience ourselves as one with the masses, and then be able to experience the call and the word of forgiveness. Okay, that could happen because Isaiah 6 is there, right? But what we live in a among a people of unclean lips who are in absolute denial about that. And so the reality is, I mean, this is where what you're saying about it being descriptive, you know, versus prescriptive, what?
Yeah, right.
Is, I think, right on. You know, this is a very dark sort of word that Isaiah has, no doubt about it. You know, hear, but don't get it. You know, see, but don't see, don't perceive. It's dark, but I think it's the message. You know, what if you look through the whole story of, you know, of the Old Testament, you know, story after story after story after story, you see the chosen people as being exemplary of a people that go from brokenness, you know, to being rescued and then to becoming successful or blessed, a state of blessedness that quickly leads to a state of hardness of heart and where there's us-them distinctions and oppression happens. And then judgment, okay, and then the people are down again. And, you know, this up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down thing, okay?
When does that stop, though?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know. Another way of saying is God is telling Isaiah, you know, I want you to proclaim this, but I'm warning you now that they're not going to listen, they're not going to see. But that doesn't mean that you don't keep proclaiming.
Exactly.
Because somebody is finally, somebody will. But but in general, I'm warning you ahead of time.
They on their own are not going to.
I don't know. I think we're not hearing the hardness of this last line. If they did, they might turn to me and be healed. That's a hard word for me to hear.
Yeah.
That's like... I mean, I don't think we can make this nice somehow. Well, that's really not that mean.
Why I was hoping for that very last line is there's this sort of enigmatic hope, and it's really, really tiny. that holy seed is a stump. That there's some little
dead in the ground,
something
in the
might
winter.
Come out of death.
Well, you know, I think of it as kind of practical. I mean, the Lord's kind of reaching out and doing this thing and setting the guy up for what his ministry is, or whatever you want to think about it, and telling him that he might not succeed, but he still has the thing to do, you know, that's his thing to do.
What's the pension plan, though?
Well, that's not in there.
That's,
the plan is in there. Well, you're going to have trouble. You know, the dam up there in Copper Creek has broken, and you're sitting here without electricity and a water supply, and, you know, we go from there, you know.
I wanted to go back to what you said earlier about, you know, some of us might be lucky enough to be like Isaiah and have God actually step in and reach us. What do the rest do, you know, who do not have that experience? But I think that, you know, as you so neatly put it yesterday, following the teachings of the Rabbi Jesus, what the rest of us do is look for God in the poor, and that people like Mother Teresa, who claim that's where she found Jesus and that's where she found God, was in those ministries.
Well, this afternoon we're going to look at that question in depth, okay? What is the role of the servant of the Lord? And just, oh, it's so beautiful when you look at Deuteronomy, 2nd Isaiah, I mean, the exiled community. I mean, see, you guys, I work with people that have just crashed, completely burned, okay? You know, just dealing with a pastor who's, a Latino pastor who's charged with sexual abuse of a couple of children. You know, I mean, it's been in all the papers. This guy has just gone from having his church and having a really nice, you know, kind of world scene and everything. Now he's just gone to the very bottom, just crashed. And he's just under public scrutiny, and he's in humiliation, and... You know, when you're a sexual predator of children and you're in the jail system, man, you get hammered on, okay? I watched this guy come to a place of utter brokenness, okay? Where I think God is really touching him deeply, too. You know, I see all kinds of unclean people experiencing the effects of, you know, of just the consequences of their behaviors and having encounters with God that are just incredibly powerful. You know, I get to see all kinds of people come to faith in my ministry. You know, I mean, 20 at a time sometimes. Okay, where people will respond to the you know, the message of grace and love. I mean, just so receptive. You know, because they really have nothing else. I mean, they're really like Isaiah. I am a man of unclean lips among a people of unclean lips. They feel like scum of the earth, you know, they're just at the very bottom. When they hear the message of grace, they're just like thirsty. They just soak it, drink it in, okay? And they're so in open. And, you know, and I often go right from that jail Bible study, you know, into a kind of a mainstream kind of place. Or I go right from a mainstream congregation where I'm preaching or something into the jail, and it's so much easier to minister among the exiles, okay, than it is among the mainstream. Because, I don't fear, I guess, everything falling apart, because I see how God comes close to people who are completely broken. Okay, what I fear is the false security of the empire, okay, and how it lulls people to a place of self-justification and collective justification. I fear that, you know, and my greatest concern about our situation right now in America is we are doing some of the most destructive things around to the planet. You know, in all over the world we have our campaigns, and, you know, we're recruiting the poorest of the poor from our cities and our high schools and everything to go and do all this, you know, I mean, these military campaigns all to protect whose interests, okay? I mean, this empire is really in serious decline. Okay, and is the church going to wake up and have the courage to be able to speak the prophetic word?
The problem is the church is so divided, and I think that's another issue. And where do we find ourselves? You know, if we don't feel ourselves siding with the status quo, and we're maybe not, maybe we don't personally think that we're the ones on the bottom. Where are we?
And then, at least I was amazed that all these representatives from many, many church bodies in the U.S. wanted to meet with Bush as a group before he went into Iraq. He just wouldn't, it was so simple, I won't talk to you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Could it be that Isaiah is in fact not being sent to the down and out?
I don't think Isaiah is being sent to the down and out.
But to the religious establishment?
I think so, yeah.
And his job is to tell them that they are in fact a people of unclean lips.
Yes.
His job is in fact to tell
them they're in trouble.
Blunt their comprehension.
Right, and that's the
problem. And because then later on, then there's going to be the burning, and the oaks are going to be burned, and then finally, in the last verse, the 13, even if a tenth part remain, it will be burned again, and like the terebinth or an oak whose stump remains standing when it is felled, and then the holy seed is its stump. In other words, when everything has come down to the basics, then that's where the holy seed is. In fact, it reminds me a little bit of the sort of understanding of the remnant.
Mm-hmm. Right.
When everything has been brought low, destroyed, then there is the faithful remnant that is going to be the holy seed.
Or there's the holy seed that's in your heart that never gets snatched away, okay? Because the Spirit of God has been placed in you in your baptism, and it's not an end. Nothing will snatch it away. You know, you belong. You know, you're a child of God. You know, I mean, the holy seed cannot be taken away, no matter what happens to you. Okay, the exile, destruction of everything. You know, the loss of everything is not the. You know, we don't need to fear that. You know, as if we're people who believe in the resurrection, in the cross and the resurrection, and we're people that can stand in the face of anything.
That doesn't mean we don't care about the loss of everything. We don't try to prevent the loss. It just means that we don't we don't fret completely.
No.
About
No.
That's right. And so our calling to be a prophetic people is a calling to be a prophetic people in solidarity with the unclean, whoever they are. So there's no room for us then distinctions in our proclamation, okay? And this is what's powerful about Isaiah. Isaiah goes from being an insider to still being an insider in a way, but he's just an insider that's had his eyes opened, okay? And been pardoned, okay? He's lost his edge. I think he doesn't have an edge, an insider sort of edge. I mean, you know, I can have an insider sort of edge after being in Central America and doing all the kind of the righteous left things that you can do. You know, you can come back and have, you guys all know people that have an insider edge. Mm-hmm. You know, because you know you're a campaigner for justice or this or that. You know, for me, that edge got wiped out very quickly because I was down in Honduras trying to be, you know, Mr. Downwardly Mobile, and I realized that if I was going to be as downwardly mobile as I needed to be a brother with the peasants, then I would need to die, okay? Because I couldn't stand having all the parasites that your average peasant has,
right,
you know? Okay. You know, I mean, your average peasant, how's it going, Jorge? Well, fine, Roberto, muy bien, you know, I'm doing great. You know, he doesn't tell you that he's got, like, his feet are just practically destroyed from athlete's foot, you know, because he doesn't have anything for the fungus. And, you know, he's got 20 different kinds of parasites, and he's been eating, you know, like, corn tortillas because he's in the Junios, the Junes, where he's run out of his harvest, and he's just desperately poor, and he has to work long hours to get and there's no social security, no welfare system for him. I mean, this guy's just, everything that he makes, everything he eats has to be by the sweat of his brow, okay? And I was trying to be Mr. De Downwardly Mobile, and Gracie and I think we realized very quickly that we could not be peasants. We couldn't be Honduran peasants. Okay, we couldn't save ourselves through descending and through kind of cleaning ourselves, you know, through righteous sort of solidarity. And it was at that point of absolute bottoming out that I feel like I had sort of an Isaiah-like experience when I was in Honduras where I felt like God said yes to me, even though I was white and privileged and you know, and I've still been trying to struggle with that for the last 20 years, to say yes to myself. You know, I mean, I've heard God's yes over and over. Okay, but you know, but it's saying it's receiving, I guess, that gesture from above. Okay, over and over again, that I think takes the edge away from us.